live from Aspen Public Radio. It's Valley Roundup. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. It's been another week of news full of sexual harassment allegations, including at Colorado State House. The city of Aspen has some work to do to prove that it should hold on to conditional water rights on Castle and Maroon Creeks, and is considering pulling funding from the Wheeler stockpile to buy land in Woody Creek. The school district is also interested in the Wheeler's excess funds. And is it really almost ski season? Aspen Skiing Company has big plans for Aspen Mountain, but they don't include Thanksgiving World Cup. All that and more coming up on Valley Roundup. Joining me today to put all this in context and give insights is Benta Berkland, Aspen Public Radio's State House correspondent. Thanks for calling in, Benta.
Happy to be with you.
Here in the studio is Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. And also in the studio is Brent Gardner-Smith, executive director of Aspen Journalism. Thanks for being here, Curtis.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome, Brent.
Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Let's start with news out of the state capitol. So, Benta, you broke a story last week about allegations of sexual harassment against Representative Steve Lebsack. That story has grown every day, and now there are allegations against three lawmakers, one Democrat and now two Republicans as well. Can you give us some background on what's been happening at the state capitol?
Yep, it's definitely been a pretty big week. Like you said, about a week ago, we broke the story on Lebsack, and pretty much, you know, almost everyone I talked to had an issue with him, and there were just a lot of complaints. I didn't really know him very well. We have 100 lawmakers here, and he's someone I just hadn't talked to much. I'd seen him on the chamber floor, but I didn't have a personal working relationship with him. So I knew he had a temper, but beyond that, I wasn't really tipped off to him in particular. So we've had a lot of movement there. Top Democrats have called for his resignation, and Republicans are calling for an independent investigation into how Democratic leaders who control the House handled Lebsack. They knew about concerns arising him and still made him a committee chair. Now, the Speaker of the House and the Democratic lawmaker who accuses him of soliciting her kind of for sex and trying to drag her out of a party that happened a year ago at the end of the legislative session, there's a big party. You know, she says that, Faith Windsor didn't want him to go farther. They thought he was going to get help. But needless to say, Republicans aren't happy that they weren't brought into the process. When there were concerns about Lebsack, people had gone to Democratic leaders. So that's playing out. Lebsack has not said he would resign. He's pushing back. He said he's being blackmailed by a Colorado activist who now lives in Michigan who's trying to force him out. And then he also feels like he hasn't had his due process. Since then, two of the women who've gone public have filed formal complaints against Lebsack. And that's what's happening there. He says at the end of the month he'll have a press conference and he'll announce whether or not he's going to resign. He's also running for state treasurer. So a lot on the Lebsack side.
And he'll decide about if he'll continue the campaign for state treasurer at the same time. He'll make that announcement at the same time as if he's going to step down.
I think he's going to talk about his political future on November 30th.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about your process in reporting the story? It's clearly really sensitive. As you said, you didn't have much of a relationship with Lebsack, and now he's saying he felt harassed. Both the Republican lawmakers have denied allegations, and many of these people involved work together. So how did you work through breaking the news?
It was pretty tough. I mean, I've been here for quite a few years, and so I do know a lot of people, and, you know, it's just talking to folks and seeing what surfaces. I knew after the Lebsack story broke that there's a lot of stuff happening in the Senate, but as a reporter, you can't just call someone out with an anonymous source or something that you think's true or someone told you something that happened. It's very serious allegations, so you have to be very factual and everything has to be corroborated, and both of the stories went through our attorney. So it's a very, very lengthy process. For instance, with the story on Senator Jack Tate, a Republican. I thought I had the story, and an investigative reporter mentor said, no, you're just not there yet. So, you know, you really have to have things locked down, and it's a little bit a different dynamic. The Senate, Republicans only have a one-seat majority. There's only 35 senators, so each person has more power, and there's more at stake in terms of switching the chamber. Democrats, it's a wider majority. And even if everyone didn't know about the sexual harassment instances with Lebsok, I think it's pretty safe to say that he was disliked pretty broadly throughout the Capitol. I haven't talked to anyone who wanted to defend him. Everyone has told me I just wanted to stay away from him. I was told to stay away from him. He waved a finger in my face. He yelled at me. So a lot of people had problems with Lebsok. And in the Senate, it's been a little different, you know, especially after that story broke. Everyone was kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, and there's been a lot of tension in the building and rumors and text messages and this person and that person. And, you know, because there's, in any workplace, people kind of have their assumptions about who it could be. So that's been the challenge. And then getting someone to be public about a topic that's very uncomfortable, they don't want to talk about. We talk about it in the first story. There's a power dynamic here, whether it's a lobbyist or an intern and an aide and a sitting legislator. So there's a lot at stake when it comes to people's careers and business and personal relationships and reputations in the Capitol.
Right.
So it's been challenging on every possible front.
Is your sense that, I mean, it sounds like, as you say, he was pretty thoroughly disliked around the Capitol. Why now? Does it feel like this is kind of the right timing for our culture, for people to understand and believe in sexual harassment allegations? Or why do you think people waited for this to come to light?
Well, one of my sources, after talking to them, said no one's ever asked us before.
Oh, wow.
So, and, you know, in my case, why did I start asking? I think it is because of the national movement that's happening with Me Too and the stories we're hearing around the country. I was reading some national stories out of Florida about a Republican budget committee chair and how, you know, he was involved in sexual harassment, and that was a state. I don't think they have term limits, so everything went through this budget committee chair, and people amassed a lot of power. And initially, I kind of thought, well, you know, we don't have a huge problem in Colorado. We have, for quite a few years, we've had the state that has the highest percentage of female lawmakers, and right now we are tied with a couple other states. It's about 40% of the lawmakers here are female, and we have more female lobbyists, and we don't have term limits. I mean, we do have term limits. I've heard mixed reactions about that, but I was going into it thinking, well, we have term limits, so people can't amass as much power. I've since heard folks say term limits aren't the answer. They feel like legislative leaders don't have time to really get a handle on the job, and you have so much turnover with lawmakers that, you know, maybe the decorum isn't followed as much. So I think that could split either way. But that's why I started asking the question. And I do feel like this moment in time when people are talking about it so much nationally, if there's ever a time where someone might feel more comfortable going public, that they're going to get other people supporting them versus kind of saying, shutting them down or dismissing it, you know, timing is everything. So even if I'd asked this question 8-9 months ago, I don't know if I would have gotten the same answers that I did in the last week and a half.
Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to work with the women who are coming forward with these allegations? Are those relationships that you've developed over a long period of time, or and are they being treated? How are they being received now?
Well, so far, I think publicly for the lawmakers, we have obviously Steve Lebsok and then two Republicans. And these are allegations within the building. There's another Democrat, but it was an incident that happened. It was reported on. That wasn't in the Capitol when he was a sitting lawmaker. But for the two senators, Randy Baumgardner and Jack Tate, and then Steve Lebsok, a Democrat, you know, they've pretty much denied doing anything they shouldn't have done. So we haven't had anyone really apologize. Senator Tate said, I feel bad if I made someone uncomfortable, but, you know, no one's essentially said, I'm sorry and I shouldn't have done this. So there's been denial. I don't know what's going to happen necessarily. You know, Lebsok hasn't been great with the people who've come forward. You know, there's been some conflict, so that makes people less likely to want to come forward. And if he doesn't resign, they may have to vote him out of office. I think it's a 2/3 vote in the Senate, you know, in the House. So there's, you know, still a lot of moving parts, and you know, it maybe helps that I'm a woman, but it's still not something anyone wants to talk about. And there's things you know and you wish you could report. And so even if you feel like you're shedding some light on some wrongdoing, there's other things that you kind of just feel like, oh, if I could only report this. But you can't force a source to go public if they don't want to. And you've got to be very delicate about these things, and people have a lot at stake. And there can be a variety of reasons where someone does not want to go forward.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Benta. It's Curtis Wackerly from Aspen Daily News. Thanks for your work on this and for being in this really important moment and story that we're in. I was just curious, you know, are the people you're talking to, are they reluctant to go forward? Did it take some convincing? I mean, how were they feeling about putting themselves out there like this?
Yeah, they were reluctant, yeah. Yes. In one case, someone wasn't that reluctant, but in most cases, it's people are extremely reluctant. And so I actually had to have an incident where I've never had to do this as a reporter, you know, where I said, you know, if you don't say anything, I'm going to count to five, and if you don't say anything, you're confirming something. And that's how I had to confirm something. Wow. So that the person could say they didn't tell a reporter. And, you know, I've never done that. But you have to use those kind of techniques. And it was challenging, you know, because you don't want to push people too hard, but at the same time you feel so committed to getting that story out there. And so it's a balancing act. I've learned, like, I never took a psychology class, but I learned a lot about psychology 101 in the last, you know, week and a half or so. But, you know, and it's also just being down here and people trust your work, and you don't have to be best friends with people, but they, you know, they have to just, you know, there does have to be a level of trust.
I'm also curious, has Lebsok addressed the specific allegation of this, you know, this incident at a Christmas party? I mean, you have amazingly detailed sourcing, and it's corroborated by other people who witnessed it. So has he specifically said, you know, how he somehow wasn't doing what he was seen to be doing?
Yeah, he's, you know, he's issued statements kind of, I'm sorry if I made you feel this way to these women, but, you know, I guess my playful words were taken out of context, or, you know, I didn't mean it like this. So he hasn't, you know, he's waffled back and forth. You know, the first time I talked to him, I tried to give him details, and it was just kind of, well, I don't even know what you're talking about. But since then, he's gone further, but then it switched to he's being harassed, and he feels like it's a conspiracy against him, and he hasn't had due process. So, what? You know, people who know him say that he's pretty feisty, and they didn't expect him to just resign. I think if someone else had been in his situation, and we had a lot of other people who've gone to leadership about him who were in the story, I mean, I interviewed them, but they didn't want their names out there. So that added heft to it, that it wasn't just one lawmaker who had an issue. There were a lot of people that did. But okay. So that's why it's going to be so interesting to see what happens on November 30th. Some people told me they think he might drop out of the treasurer's race but still be a state representative. I just don't know.
Yeah, how do you? It's a tough needle to thread right there.
Yeah, thank you, Benta, for joining us. You are listening to Valley Roundup, live from Aspen Public Radio, clearly live. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, and giving us the backstory today are Benta Berkland, Aspen Public Radio State House correspondent, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, and Brent Gardner-Smith, executive director of Aspen Journalism. Benta, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll keep an eye out for future developments.
It was great to talk to you guys.
Thanks. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Valley Roundup. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. I'm joined in the studio live today by Brent Gardner-Smith and Curtis Wackerly. And Brent and Curtis, you guys have both been reporting on the city of Aspen's work to first hold on to conditional water rights and also transfer those rights from Castle and Maroon Creeks to a property that it has under contract in Woody Creek. Brent, the city is in water court working to hold on to those rights, those conditional water rights on Castle and Maroon Creeks. Can you give us kind of a summary of the latest news out of water court?
They held a status conference in the case with the water court referee on November 9th, and she gave the city until December 29th to provide quote-unquote substantive answers to questions raised by her and the division engineer. And the questions are pretty threshold questions in what's called a summary of consultation. Both the water court referee and the division engineer said the city, quote, must demonstrate that it will secure permits and land use approvals that are necessary to apply the subject water rights to beneficial use, unquote, and that it will, quote, complete the appropriations within a reasonable time, unquote, and that, quote, a specific plan is in place to develop the subject water rights, unquote, and, quote, that the city is not speculating with the subject water rights, unquote. And those are all threshold questions in a diligence proceeding. So okay, they want the city to make their case in a way that they haven't yet made.
So that's water court saying, city of Aspen, to hold on to these, you need to show us that you're meeting these conditions.
Yep.
Does that mean that even if the city of Aspen were to come to some sort of a settlement with the other groups who are opposing them in this case, that the state could actually say, you don't show us that you have, that you intend to use these as they're intended?
City's trying to reach settlement agreements with the 10 parties that are opposing them in water court, and they could do that. And all those parties could agree that the city has been diligent, but then the water court could find on its own that, I'm sorry, city of Aspen, we don't think you have been diligent, and therefore we don't think you have any water rights to transfer. It's a possibility. It's according to attorneys I've talked to, it's pretty unusual for a water court to do that if all the parties have agreed to a settlement, but it's possible. And then the city would have an option to appeal the water court's decision to a water court judge and go to trial.
Okay. Now, as you said, the city is working on transferring those rights to this land in Woody Creek. And Curtis, you recently reported on some developments on how the city wants to finance that purchase.
Right. Well, these two things are very intertwined. You know, one thing I'm curious about with Brent, with respect to your story, I mean, if they can't show that they could get a land use approval or a permit, which seems like a pretty heavy lift, would it be sufficient for them to say, well, maybe we can't do that, but we think we could do it here on this Woody Creek site if they can satisfy those threshold questions for this other site? I think a big question here is that sufficient to, for them to proceed ahead and succeed in their diligence filing?
Well, throughout reporting the story, I've been definitely at the edge of my experience and knowledge. And so when you talk to a water court attorney about diligence, he says, well, it all depends on the specific case and it all depends on the water court official, whether it's a referee or a judge. The analogy that I've used, it's like when your mom tells you to clean up your room, you can go in and make it look like you've done some work, and maybe that satisfies your mom and maybe it doesn't. So I don't really know. It's unclear what the city really has to do to prove that it's actually been making progress on developing these reservoirs. And of course, it's an uncomfortable question for the city because I don't think they're eager to show the citizens that they have been making progress on building a dam within view of the Maroon Bells.
Right. I mean, and really for them, it's a perfect scenario to say, well, no, we can't really show diligence there, but we can certainly show diligence here at this other site, even though it's new and it's very conceptual. That's a much easier conversation for them to be having. And, maybe perhaps unlike the Castle and Maroon sites, they actually can show that they've been studying and they've been putting putting forth strong effort toward this.
Right. So in my analogy, it's like, well, I didn't clean up my room, but I cleaned up my sister's room. And I don't know if that's good enough for mom or not.
We're not sure if that counts.
When do you go and ask dad if he can?
Yeah, there you go.
So the city of Aspen wants to purchase this land. It's been under contract since July for $2.65 million. They announced that they would ask voters to support some general obligation bonds, which is often how governments raise money to do big projects and then pay it back over time. And you go to the bond market, it's, it's traded like a security, right? So it's a very formal thing, and you have to get a voter approval to take out these bonds because they're staked against your taxes. If you couldn't pay it back under whatever plan you had, you would have to somehow raise taxes to pay these bonds. And that's why it's a voter question.
Right.
So It was always such a strange thing, because as much as a month, maybe even more than that, before the vote, you had the city staff who's driving this whole process and, you know, trying to come up with this plan and you know, show that they're doing their diligence here. Well before the election, came out and said, oh, you know, if the voters turn down the bonds, then, you know, we recommend that you just buy this anyway using some other financing plan. And I think the council even took a vote on a resolution before the election saying they would, yeah, in fact do just that. So, you know, going into it, it's like, it was just...
It's tough to know how to vote on,
yeah,
a question,
you know,
like that.
It's a great way to depress turnout, I would say. and so lo and behold, it lost by 10 points. And, you know, less than a week later, the city council met and discussed this, which I would note was not really noticed before on an agenda. They added this to their Tuesday work session agenda at their Monday regular meeting. And if they actually posted a physical paper agenda in City Hall, they may have done that. They did not update their website. There was nothing to tell the public looking on their website that this was going to be discussed on Tuesday, where they came to the decision that instead of tapping their water fund at a high rate, which would cause ratepayers' rates to increase, or doing any sort of alternate financing, they would go to the Wheeler Opera House here in Aspen, which is a 128-year-old theater building that is the beneficiary of a very healthy tax revenue stream every year that typically produces more money than the theater needs to support its operating and its maintenance. So all this money, you know, has been building up over almost 40 years in a savings account, which now sits with a $31 million balance.
Which sounds like a lot of money, but I think one of the columnists in the Aspen Daily News this week made a point that if that's the reserve fund for this building that's aging, that might,
yes,
not be quite as much money as it sounds,
right,
like.
Yeah, no, $30 million is not going to take you all that. I mean, this was Paul Minter's column in the Daily News on Wednesday, which, you know, he estimated, like, if he had to actually go and replace the building, you're looking at more like $150 million, not 30. So when you put it in those terms, it starts to look like a smaller amount. I mean, if all you were ever going to do is maintain the Wheeler in more or less its current state, its current type of programming, not do an expansion onto the open parcel to the west that the city owns, that it bought specifically for the purpose of expanding the Wheeler and is
right,
often brought up in conversation. If you weren't going to do that and you weren't going to change much about how the Wheeler was operated, you could make the argument that maybe you're starting to get close to having enough money where you could, you know, start talking about giving away significant portions of it. Those are a lot of ifs.
Right.
And we don't really know the answer to that yet. You know, the Wheeler, I know, is working on this. Like, what is our realistic long-term plan? What do we think our needs are going to be as far as capital replacements? What does our programming look like in the future? Are we going to ask for more money from the rec? Because right now, I mean, roughly two-thirds of that facility's operating budget is supported by this rent revenue, which is a real estate transfer tax that people pay when they engage in trading Aspen real estate.
The city's borrowed from that fund before, though, for other purposes, right?
They have. They've done it a couple times in the past. There have been three instances that that I was made aware of in the last 20 or so years. it's sort of in the Hall of Fame of transactions that will go down in infamy. The BMC West parcel back in 2007, the city paid $18 million and change for a lumber yard out at the ABC, which almost nobody thinks is actually worth that. And when they made that purchase, and this was in a very frenzied time, affordable housing, land banking. You may not agree with the purchase price, although you may agree with the overall mission that they were engaged in. Anyway, they borrowed $8 million from the Wheeler to finance that $18 million purchase and paid the loan back in 3 years. You know, they're usually pretty good about paying themselves back. And that's one funny thing here. Apparently, this $31 million sits in an account that collects, you know, interest of roughly 1% a year. So not all that much. So all they have to do is pay it back at you know,
at 1%
to 2.6%, and it's screaming deal.
That is not the only, the city borrowing from itself through the Wheeler Fund, that's not the only entity that's interested in this money that came forward this week, right?
Right. It's really funny. And I think it's something of a coincidence that these both happened in the same 2 week span. But as we were talking about earlier, there's there's this money sitting there, and there's definitely some suitors who are looking at that conspicuously, saying, "Oh, there's so much money, maybe we could put some of that toward a better purpose," which may or may not be debatable. But
right.
We're certainly having this conversation. It's been a conversation for a while as to whether or not any repurposing is something that the community wants to do. But the Aspen School District has, you know, more or less officially put its hand up and said, you know, we would like to work with you on something related to this. And their proposal is that any money they would get from the Wheeler would go toward the arts. And, you know, obviously public school district is where all of the young people of this world tend to get their first introduction to the arts. And that can be such an important, valuable thing. So that would be someplace where some more funds could help the school district with its mission, strengthen the community overall, as they're arguing. But it's very informal now. They only went to the Wheeler Opera House Board of Directors, basically suggested this is maybe something that could happen. There's no numbers. I've asked them if they have an idea of how much they would actually want. They say, we don't know yet. The right. conversation's just starting. You know, it would have to go to city council. It would have to go to the voters. One thing that's interesting is you actually could theoretically get a group of people together, write a referendum ordinance, and put something on the ballot that says, hey, let's repurpose some amount of these Wheeler dollars to this, and totally go over the council's head.
Is that an idea that's been floated?
That idea has, in fact, been floated, but pulled back on, and the school district is now saying, no, we wouldn't do that. We want to work together.
Got it. All right. Well, let's finish out today's conversation by talking a little bit about ski season. We don't have much snow up there. We saw some reports this week about local athletes and skiing, and I'm wondering, what do you guys make of the fact that we don't have World Cup this year? Is this a blessing that we don't have World Cup, putting the pressure on Aspen Skiing Company to get the hill open?
Probably right now, at least the way the conditions have shaped out. At least if it does get cold and they can make snow, they can make it in Spar and on Nell where they'd like, rather than on the race course. So I guess that's a blessing.
Sure. I mean, if we were having a World Cup ski race in a week,
you feel a lot of nervous people
right now. I would say that would not be something. So obviously the World Cup was great, and we missed the World Cup, and that was a very special way to start the ski season, to bring sort of the world, you know, all the world class skiers here. And I always found it to be a cool event.
Kind of the kickoff to winter.
Yeah, it's a kickoff to winter. It's a nice reason to celebrate or go watch a ski race. But I would add, we've now not had it for 2 years, and these have been two of the driest Novembers in my memory in 12 years in this town.
Okay, that's going to do it for this week's Valley Roundup. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. We are live on Aspen Public Radio. I was joined in the studio today by Brent Gardner-Smith of Aspen Journalism and Curtis Wackerly, who is the editor of the Aspen Daily News. We'd like to give a huge shout out to our producer, Kristen Kay, for keeping things running and keeping us on the air. You can get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. If you missed any part of today's show, you can also listen at our website or download the podcast wherever you typically get your podcasts. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. Thanks for listening. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. We'll